yesterday we looked at the Cartan structural equations, and then I kind of zipped through the calculation of the curvature of a spherically symmetric static space-time. So we had a metric of this form. So this is your standard metric on a unit two sphere, the d omega. Hopefully you've seen the notation before. And we calculated the curvature, the connection one forms and the curvature two forms. So I'll just write them down again. Okay, so that was where we got to yesterday. So it's, you know, the purpose of actually going through that algebra was just to indicate that calculating the curvature using this method is fairly straightforward. So what tends to not happen with this method is when you're using the sort of component definition of Riemann, so you have all the Christoffel symbols summed over some indices, et cetera, you've kind of got to be careful to remember when there is a summation that you sum over all the indices, and you've got to be careful to make sure that you look at all the options. So this way, it's, I think, slightly easier. So we can read off Riemann from this. Because remember, these two forms were given by the components of the Riemann tensor. For example, if I look, I've got six independent two forms. So I look here, this is our TR. I kind of refer to this. So the two form, the TR two form, is Riemann TRCD, omega C wedge omega D. And I see that the only omega C wedge omega D here are the R and T components. So I can really just read it off. And similarly, for T theta, we've got, you know, the C omega C cross omega D is omega T cross omega theta. So it's actually quite straightforward to just read off those Riemann components. And you sort of see this pattern emerging that anything with the R in it is a second, gives you a second derivative of the function associated with the other coordinate. So for example, TRTR, the function associated with dt squared is A, and that's the A double primed on A in there. So the theta R is the C double primed on C. So you sort of start to, but by doing this method and finding, you know, the Riemann by hand, you start to build up a feel for the patterns and what things look like. So I just want to make a note that these components are in an orthonormal basis. So you always have to be a bit careful. That's why I hack the indices, because it's easy to sort of slip back and think of things in terms of their coordinate forms. But for example, you notice that the Riemann with two thetas down, t theta is the same if you replace theta with phi. So that's kind of how you know it's in an orthonormal basis, because if it were coordinate basis, there'd be a relative factor of sine squared theta there. So to get to a coordinate basis is actually quite straightforward. In this case, at least. Because if we look at the tensor, the Riemann tensor, we get that by looking at the components of Riemann. Let me hat everything to make it clear. So that's what the Riemann tensor is. But then I could say, well, what are those components in a coordinate basis? Well, the coordinate basis is d by dx mu, if you remember. And so you get this sort of matrix of components of the orthonormal basis vectors. So that's E and omega. It's likewise. So in our case, our metric was very straightforward. It was block diagonal. So if I want to go from orthonormal basis to coordinate basis, these are only non-zero when A is mu. So so in the sense that if A hat is T hat and mu is T, then it's non-zero, but otherwise it's zero, because remember that omega T hat was A dt. So this is our coordinate basis, and this is omega T hat T. I hope that's clear. So in other words, this is what I get. I simply multiply by the appropriate weights. And so if I go through and do that every time I see, if I want a component with a T downstairs, say here, so if nu is T, I done something daft? Yeah, I have. This, I knew this would happen, sorry. we go. So if I'm looking, for example, for nu equals t, I see this basis for the form, one form basis element here, and so I multiply by a. If the t were there, I'd divide by a. So that's just the sort of the pattern. So if I just want the coordinate basis, actually the easiest thing to do is to raise an index. Because then all these relative factors cancel out. And honestly, it takes longer to write out than it does to work it out. So that is now our Riemann tensor for that metric, and we're now in a position to actually look for solutions to the Einstein equation with this particular set of symmetries. So let's just take a simpler gauge, because I deliberately left my gauge general. So take C as R. So if C is R, then this C double primed drops out, and C primed is just 1. So if I look at my Ricci, etc. Okay, so I simply take the contraction of the Riemann tensor to get the Ricci tensor, and I've taken the area gauge. So now you start to sort of see some sort of coincidences. So if I look at TT and RR, the first two terms are the same, and the last one is really just replacing A with minus B. And theta, theta, and phi, phi are just first derivatives. So when I take the Ricci scalar, so I'm going to have 2a double primed on a here, and then I calculate the Einstein tensor, my g naught naught is actually not going to have any second derivatives in it at all. So when I calculate what the Einstein tensor is, the naught-naught component, so you see that I look at RTT, I've got A double primed on A minus, it leads with A double primed on A minus A prime B prime on AB, but then I see I have in my half Ricci exactly the same term, because when I sum up all those Ricci components, take the trace, I end up with two A double prime on A minus 2A prime B prime on AB. Then I've also, if I kind of keep going down, I see that I have 2a primed on ar from rtt and another 2 from the theta, theta, and phi, phi. So again, when I take half minus a half Ricci on rtt, that 2a primed on ar also drops out. And so all that I'm left with, I've kind of taken care of all the terms in that RTT. I've used up this term in the trace and those two terms in the trace. So what I'm left with is a sort of 2b primed on br, and then I've got these two pieces here, but they also only involve b. So what I end up with is a first order differential equation for b, which is kind of nice. This is equal to 8 pi g t naught naught. And so I can write my solution for B as an integral of t naught naught. Now, in a hugely strong gravity situation, we're not so sure how we should be interpreting T naught naught, but if we're in a fairly weak gravity situation, T naught naught should be the energy. And so this integral here looks like the energy, or the integrand, between R and R plus dr. So we are sort of integrating out a total energy density. And so we write this with some justification as 1 over b squared is 1 minus 2g m of r on r. So we've not really made a huge assumption yet. So, of course, if we take a vacuum solution, this is going to give you something very familiar. So that means I've got one of my metric functions. Then I look at RTT minus RRR. Both of the Ricci's are zero. But if I subtract those two off, I get 2 on B squared into A primed on A, on RB squared, plus B primed on B. And that has to be zero. And so what I see is that A is 1 over B. And so I get the Schwarzschild solution.
So why RTT minus RR is 0?
Because both RTT and RRR are 0 separately. But in particular, I want to take the difference so I can get rid of the A double primed on A bit. I know what B is now. I need to know what A is. And the easiest way of finding that is to just take the difference so I get rid of the bits that are making it messy. Okay, so that's the vacuum solution, which you've already met. So what if I have a lambda? So a cosmological constant. So that's where my 8 pi g tab is equal to lambda gab. So of course, this is one of these examples where lambda was first introduced for one reason, only to find out that that reason was completely non-valid. Then for many years, lambda was just thought to be utterly irrelevant. Back when I was a student or starting postdoc, everybody wanted to make lambda zero. So there was this whole industry with wormholes allegedly making lambda zero. And then less than 10 years later, a positive lambda was observed with the supernova data. And now, of course, a negative lambda is pretty central to a lot of, you know, sort of pragmatic string theory these days with the gauge gravity duality. So kind of one of these lucky accidents. So if we have a lambda, then I can input the fact that t naught naught is constant over here. And so all I'm doing is integrating r squared, which gives me r cubed on 3. Then I divide by r. And then I get this plus, you know, if I have my integration constant, then I've got the minus 2gm on r. So as before, although the Ricci's are no longer zero, because you have a cosmological constant, they're still equal. So we still have this relation. So we still know that A is 1 over B. So this solution is called the Schwarzschild ante or der Sitter. And it represents a black hole in either a positive cosmological constant spacetime or a negative cosmological constant spacetime. So if we have a positive cosmological constant, well, let me say that lambda is 3 over capital L squared. Then we kind of see that this L is telling us something about a sort of radius of curvature of the geometry. So in general, A squared has two zeros. So when you first met the Schwarzschild solution, you'll have seen the horizon of the black hole, which was at 2gm. Well, when you add in a cosmological constant, it shifts it from 2gm. But as long as L is very big, it doesn't shift it very much. So now we have two horizons. And R being close to L is what we call a cosmological horizon. So I think there's still a cosmology course. So when you look at cosmology, the universe, usually everything is actually highly time dependent, and the universe is expanding. And so you get this phenomenon of redshift when you look at an object that's, you know, reasonably far away, because it's moving away from you. So you get this redshift. Now, if you have a lambda, things accelerate away from you. So things, you know, really move very fast away from you. And then you reach this limit where an object is so far away from you, it's kind of infinitely redshifted. So that's the cosmological horizon from a more time-dependent description. Here, this is a completely static metric, so I can set m to zero, so I'm just in de Sitter, and there's no time dependence at all, and that kind of looks a little bit weird. But that's simply because, yet again, it's an issue of gauge. We find that we can write our solutions often in many different ways. And this is a really good example. There's a lot of ways that we can slice, if you like, our de Sitter space. So de Sitter is a constant curvature space-time. So it's kind of the equivalent of the sphere. In fact, if you were to Euclideanize this metric, so change dt squared to minus dt squared, you would see that in fact you had the metric on a four sphere. So it can be represented or visualized as a hyperboloid. So just like we find it useful to think of the sphere not as some intrinsic two-dimensional geometry, but rather as a two-dimensional geometry embedded in three dimensions, the sitter is rather the same. If we take a flat space-time, so we have x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus u squared minus t squared, and say that is a constant L squared, then the induced metric, so the distances that we get on that hyperboloid that it inherits from the five-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, are precisely the de Sitter. So if we look at this and think about cutting it exactly horizontally, so these are all S3s, we see that we have a big S3 that kind of is shrinking, comes into a minimum, but then as we keep going up the page, it starts growing again. So that's like a cosmological interpretation. That's where we've got a time dependence of some spatial section with an overall scale that is time dependent. What about the flat embedding, the static coordinates? So there we take x, y, and z to just be r times a unit vector, and then u and t are these particular combinations. So here, x, y, and z cover all the whole range, whereas u is only strictly positive. So this is kind of a weird sort of, part of the hyperboloid. It's a quarter of the hyperboloid, roughly. Whereas the cosmological coordinates just take a fairly standard coordinates on the three sphere at constant capital T. So the cosmological coordinates have a direct relation between their time and the embedding time. So what if lambda is less than zero? This is ADS, anti-de Sitter. So we say lambda is minus 3 on L squared now. Then we can simply input this into our expression for A and B. And we get something really similar, but with the opposite sign in front of R squared on L squared.
In the cosmological coordinates with U, what do you mean by the vectors?
I'm just using it as shorthand. U is cos chi, X is sine chi. So if you think of the normal spherical polar coordinates, it's really just adding in another angle, but otherwise it looks the same as normal spherical polars. Yeah, it was just to save writing. So ADS is negatively curved. And it's kind of bizarre, does some strange things. I just want to note this point. So I could, I mean, we're so used to a two-sphere, and of course we did start off this line of thought by having taken a killing vector with an SO3 algebra, so we started off with the two-sphere. But I could ask, is it possible to have that d omega, instead of d omega being a planar object or a negatively curved two-dimensional space? Obviously that doesn't correspond with our idea of an isolated black hole, but I can at least ask the question, what does it look like? Can we get a solution? So if I do that, the calculation of the curvature goes through very similarly, and the only Ricci that is different is the angular one, which is not surprising because, of course, let me call it alpha, no, let me call them theta. So theta and phi should not be thought of as being necessarily angular coordinates. So what changes is the 1 on r squared becomes a kappa on r squared. So that then changes the solution. So it takes our a squared, which is still 1 on b squared, into kappa minus 2gm on r, plus r squared on l squared for ADS. So we now see why our black holes are round, because if we didn't have a cosmological constant, we wouldn't have this term. And therefore, without kappa being 1, our GTT would not be positive, so that's unphysical. It's even worse if you're in a positive cosmological spacetime, because then both of these terms are negative. However, for anti-de Sitter, that r squared on l squared is positive, and so you can choose kappa is 1, is 0, or minus 1. So it means that in anti-de Sitter space, we can have black holes with different topology. It's just one of these sort of curiosities of ADS that you get a lot more sort of things that can happen, which can sometimes be harder to visualize because they're a little bit weird. So I just want to wrap up by coming back to the theme of spherically symmetric solutions. So I've kind of gone and looked at exact solutions with very simple backgrounds, either vacuum or plus or minus lambda. So these are exact solutions. They're very important because they represent, you know, our sort of catalog of exact solutions that are analytic, that you can just pick off a shelf, is very, very limited. So in gravity, most of the physically interesting gravitational situations actually have to be tackled numerically. But the black hole is one of these examples where it's incredibly clean. You've just got 1 minus 2 gm on r. I mean, that's really pretty damn simple and extremely accurate, actually, in describing the objects that exist out in our universe. So it's kind of one of these amazing things where you sort of find that, you know, you're doing something that's quite formal. It's just pen and paper pushing symbols around. But then what you end up with, which is this solution, is really physically relevant. And it may not be precisely the black holes that are out there, but it's so close. And you know, the value of having an exact or analytic solution is immense. So what else can we do with exact solutions? So I'm now going to pick up the train of thought from over here, which is to solve the Einstein equations, but now to think about having an energy momentum source. So we're going to imagine, we're going to be very, very simplistic about our star. We're going to just say it's a fluid. We're not really going to worry about elasticity. It's going to be a perfect fluid. It's going to be isotropic. That's probably not true, but good enough. And it's going to have a very sharp cutoff. So we're going to solve these Einstein equations under those assumptions to see what we get. So we know that B is still gm of r on r. It's still got that factor. But then if I look at the, the radial, the grr component, that's also not going to have an a double primed on a in it. So I'm trying to keep things down to first order differential equations. So GRR has this combination of A primed on AR plus 1 on R squared. So this 1 minus 2 GM on R is B to the minus 2. So on the right hand side, we've got a 1 over R squared minus 1 over B squared times some combination of derivatives. On the left hand side, we've got a radial pressure. So hopefully you'll be able to distinguish my P's from my rows, but let me know if it's ambiguous. So I can rewrite this as an expression for A. So now I know that my time metric component is sort of varying partly with the m of r function, but also if there's a pressure, it's going to vary with that as well. So now we assume our perfect isotropic fluid . So what that means is all the pressures, the angular and radial pressures, are the same. And then use energy momentum conservation . So I write out my divergence of the energy momentum tensor, but notice I've been hatting everything. And that's because when we did our calculation yesterday of the connection, we found the connection one forms, but that was in an orthonormal basis. So I want to be able to just read off those, you know, those forms. And here, what the orthonormal d by dr is just p primed on b. So that's just that factor of the gr, root of grr. Then here, I need to look at, so I'm really picking off here, the, if I think of my connection one forms, I know that I'm going to have something, you know, r theta. So for example, let's see, I think I brought it. So I'll just do one so that it's, the train of thought is there. So r theta t hat r hat was a primed on ab omega t hat. So that tells me that gamma t hat r hat is a primed on ab, for example. So then the theta theta r is just 2 on rb. And so you see that an r theta theta is also 2 on rb, but with a minus sign. And so you see that, you know, this term here cancels that term there, and you're just left with this combination of rho plus p. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't look necessarily all that amenable to just solving. However, notice that this A primed on A here can be replaced by the expression here on the right-hand side. So things start to get a little bit messy, but at least everything is now specified. So all we need is a profile for our star. Now, again, this is a huge simplification, but it will allow us to do the calculation. So I'm going to take a top hat profile for the star. So it has some density inside a radius capital R, and then it drops to zero density immediately outside the star. It's not that bad, an approximation, but it's very simple. So our M of R inside the star is going to be increasing like R cubed, the volume. And outside the star, it's just going to be a constant, which is our mass, M. So we know that our star has some profile of energy density, and therefore, once we're outside the star, it's going to look like a Schwarzschild solution. But what happens inside as I said, we can replace that A primed on A. So our divergence of the energy momentum tensor vanishes. So that tells us how P primed. Varies in terms of P. So we have, again, a first order differential equation for our pressure here. So I can just so here on the top line, M of R and this term here, both have a functional dependence on R of R cubed. So I can kind of pull that out. So we see our P prime depends on the constant rho naught on P, but it's sort of it's a quadratic in P on the right hand side. And we've also got some quite complicated expression in terms of R. So so then I can simply cancel some of the factors of R on top and bottom to end up with this expression. So this is called the Tolman-Oppenheimer Volkoff equations for the star. And obviously when people were a bit sort of leery of these exact solutions, the exact solution that Karl Schwarzschild had found, because that seemed just a bit too weird and not relevant. And so they really wanted to have something reasonable for what was considered to be, a real object out there, your star. So this has solution. So amazingly, there's an analytic solution to that, which of course was why they made the assumptions they made in order to get this analytic solution. So this solution satisfies, as indeed it has to, that P tends to zero at the edge of the star. So we have to cut off our pressure at the edge of the star. But we also have P of R equals zero is rho zero root one minus two gm r minus one divided by one minus three root one minus two gm on r. So we're getting these factors of the Schwarzschild potential that are coming in all over the place. But notice that here, this tends to infinity. When R is 9gm over 4. So that's kind of our first example of the fact that the mass of a the mass of a star is limited. So this isn't obviously the Chandrasekhar limit, but it's saying that we start off with the simplest possible model for our star. And then we see that we are driven to an inconsistency for very large stars, because if we try and make our star too big, we have a singularity in the pressure at its core. So something's going on. So of course, people then tried to make more sophisticated models of the star, and then Chandrasekhar in the 30s actually started to think about the, what reactions could take place that would support this sort of pressure. And argued that in fact for a star of solar mass, sort of somewhere between two and three solar masses, would simply, once it ran out of nuclear fuel, there would be nothing that would stop it from collapsing. So smaller objects, for example, the Earth doesn't collapse to a black hole, but that's because of the forces in are relatively the force of gravity for the Earth is relatively weak. but if you get a supermassive star, then eventually it will collapse. So it's kind of interesting, I think, sort of watching how the community kind of danced around this concept of the black hole and was always found it a little bit unpalatable, but every time trying to get a get-out clause was always led back to the same thing. So anyway, this is a nice sort of point to stop because it's, you know, showing what we can do with spherical symmetry. So next week we're going to look a lot more at black holes, both sort of thinking about, you know, what does it mean for it to be a black hole causal structure, as well as thinking about more abstract properties of black holes or quantum properties of black holes like thermodynamics. And we'll sort of come back, pick up some thoughts I know I've had from some questions after the lectures.